Okay, this is session number 20, recorded on October 16th, 2006, and this is side one, and we're doing the LaRouche part of my book, and we're on page 46 of the LaRouche quotes, which are on the left side of the first part of the book, and we're doing a quote from LaRouche, written in his Campaigner publication in December 79. And that was when it was published, and it's called The Cantor Transfinite in Music and Poetry. And Cantor, C-A-N-T-O-R, is a thinker, scientist of the late 1800s, early 20th century. And we're doing page 23. The quote, this long quote from that article, is page 23 in that issue. So, Scott, let's hear it.
Okay. Themes in music are as lines to a poet. They are musical ideas, even on the level of primitive culture's comprehension of music. A theme must parse. It must have the preconscious form of a musical idea utterance, such that the mind seizes that utterance as a gestalt, something corresponding to a musical idea statement in and for itself. The process of composition then presents the mind with an ambivalence. Each of the musical idea statements subsumed in the developmental process is at first glance an ordinary musical idea statement. Yet it is also essentially something else, a mere predicate for the developmental process, whose meaning is essentially the latter. It is the polemical struggle within the mind between the two kinds of meaning, which is the musical experience of the audience. However, to put the composition together as a unity, the mind must subordinate the theme-by-theme hearing to hearing the developmental process. The simple statement corresponds to ordinary knowledge. The developmental process in the great musical composition corresponds at best to a higher hypothesis of Plato. Hence the difference between the master of existing musical knowledge, Johann Brahms, and the creator of new musical knowledge, Beethoven. Brahms is satisfying as a composer because he achieves lawful creative processes of musical development. He is uninspiring relative to Beethoven because Brahms' mastery of music seldom touches those processes which correspond to the higher hypothesis. Brahms is to Beethoven as Immanuel Kant stands as a poet with respect to Friedrich Schiller. This sort of use of predicated objects to force the mind to a higher order processing conception is identical with the notion of higher hypothesis in Riemann's great habilitation paper and the notion of transfinite in Cantor's work. Process conceptions occur as distinct mental notions in terms of transfinites, as Cantor defines transfinites. The higher hypothesis of Plato is the highest order transfinite possible in Cantor's implicit schema. Conversely, examining the lawful ordering of Bach's well-tempered system from the standpoint of both Beethoven and Cantor's notion of transfinite orderings, we have a more advantageous standpoint from which to comprehend both the general principle of the well-tempered system and the contrapuntal methods generally. What defines the well-tempered system for Al Fabre and Farabi and his European followers through Beethoven is not the matter of agreement of tones as such. The well-tempered system is defined by the process of musical composition under contrapuntal rules. Counterpoint within any lawful ordering within modes leads inevitably to juxtapositions which are paradoxical. They contradict the apparent law, and yet they arise through the realization of the law under contrapuntal conditions. These paradoxes are dissonances. Lawful dissonances are singularities within the domain of law. These cease to be unlawful if they are properly developed as transitions to other modes. Hence, the system of law within composition is not conserved except by allowing for the implicit concurrent existence of every other mode within each mode. The well-tempering principle is determined by this principle of necessary agreement. The values of tonalities are those which admit of coherent lawfulness within the process of musical composition as a whole. Music is not located in the physiology of a human ear or the neurophysiology of acoustico-lateral lobe. Music is located in the creative mental processes peculiar to the human being. It is as music is defined accordingly that the distinction between the human and the bestial in various profferings of so-called music is determined. This was understood by Plato and Farabi, by Ibn Sina, and by their European continuators. The distinguishing feature of rock, of Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, and other aspects of the guitar strumming, quote, modern folk song cults, is that they combine monotony with arbitrary dissonances. The, quote, modern folk song side of this overall spectrum is the most boring sort of monadic strumming, relieved scantily by occasional transpositions. The addition of the arbitrary dissonance, sometimes merely whining or cacophonous bellowing into a microphone, is the element of, quote, personal style, irrational idiosyncrasy, added on the tensible pretext of relieving the internal monotony of the rest.
Added on the tensible pretext of relieving the
relieving
the internal monotony of the rest.
There is no doubt that a gifted chimpanzee could replicate every cognitive aspect of this sort of performance. In chimpanzees, the spectacle would represent, in brief, occasional zoo exhibitions, a certain kind of achievement, at least to the purpose of clarifying the cognitive levels of Elvis Presley, a Bob Dylan, or of any one of a large accumulation of grunters, strummers, and squirmers of bedrockers.
Okay, that's a pretty strong quote. Why don't we juxtapose what you just said, because I don't know where you want to begin to understand this statement. Let's go to the next quote, because it's about joking. And he's going to describe the truly great joke. All right?
Mm-hmm.
I got a feeling this might help us understand the previous quote. So this is from quotes as PC, the principles of composition. So this is another essay done by LaRouche, published a few months before the one we just read in the Campaigner in September 79. And so it's interesting, when he's discussing music a couple months before what we just read, he has this section on joking. So I juxtaposed it with what we just read because they relate. So let's read this. This is from the September issue, 1979, page 20. So it begins the higher formal ordering of joking.
The higher formal ordering of joking, as we identified it above, is suggestive of the principles of creative genius. By being made conscious of lawfulness and the use of a good joke to bring forth important conceptions simultaneously in the minds of a substantial portion of a definite audience, the person experiencing that awareness is made conscious of lawfulness in the ordering process of his or her own judgment. Thus, a poor joke, or a poorer joke, is one which simply plays upon the ambiguities of simple consciousness without structuring experience to bring it into play, to bring into play a forced reflection on a process of lawful ordering of insight. What is required is a truly great joke art.
What is required is, and a truly great joke, colon, art, is in italics. So
mm-hmm.
What is required is a truly great joke, art.
Hmm. This must be a quality of joking, one qualitative level higher than the evoking of self-consciousness by good joking. Instead of being merely conscious of the lawful ordering of one's preconscious processes, one must have a great joke which prompts one to be aware of a lawful principle for transforming those preconscious processes. This achievement brings forth the laughter of great fundamental scientific discovery. This brings to consciousness a knowledge of the lawfulness of those mental processes by which one may willfully effect a qualitative advancement in one's mental creative powers.
So what do you make of what he's saying here?
I'm just saying, I don't know what to make of it, but apparently he feels that humor is important. Yeah.
It's like anybody who's listening to this would say, man, this guy is like tied himself in knots trying to explain something that can't be explained. But he is explaining it well once you take the time to figure out what he's saying. But if you'll notice, you have the simple awareness, then the higher hypothesis level, and then the higher hypothesis. And he's saying the second level is self-consciousness, beginning of reflection. But the third level, the great joke, not just good joking, is being aware of the whole process and how one gets to the higher hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. You see, there's a meta, we call it nowadays, level going on here,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Sophistication, complexity. I want to juxtapose. You see, to get a context here, the reason we have a lot of quotes in the LaRouche section is it's a way of getting to the complexities. I mean, McLuhan is easier to understand once you understand what he's saying, and it's aphoristic, it's simpler. But here, he's being left hemisphere conceptual. He's dealing with thought itself. He's saying that music is thought. It's not the ear, it's not physical. It is something. Basically, he's saying that music is in the tactile interval, to use McLuhan's terms. It's in the interval between the human and the bestial. So, and that would relate back, if anybody who's listening to the series remembers or goes back and listens to LaRouche on love, we're again talking about the same thing. He's applying the same instructional formula to any of the arts, any of the disciplines. So, the next quote, we'll go back to these, but we need to juxtapose a whole bunch of them just to get the common themes that are going through them. So the next quote is from, it's coded SM, so we looked that up in the back where it has the index of codes. This is from 1984, and it's a quote from The Science of the Human Mind, a treatise on fundamentals. So let's see if there's anything we can see in something he wrote 5 years later that relates to what we heard already. And this is from page 5 of that essay. And what is it, the campaigner? SM? Yes, it's still the campaigner, February 1984. So let's read this one paragraph from that essay.
By wide-ranging observations and measurements, Leonardo da Vinci and his physicist collaborator, Pacioli, demonstrated that the morphological patterns of living processes were harmonically ordered according to convergence upon the principle of the golden section. Leonardo applied this knowledge to his design of machine technologies, where the principle of the golden section and self-similar spiral rotation is used to concentrate the power and increase the energy flux density of the machine, thus accomplishing work. Leonardo recognized that the same principle of negentropy governs the lawful development of the physical universe and the human mind.
So again, he's talking about something that's lawful, and he's saying the harmonically ordered principle and processes align with the golden section. So what he's saying here must apply to music and joking, because it's always the same lawful process of creation, what he calls negentropy, and it rules. But to see the ruling of it isn't simple. It's not like saying, well, everything is this, and then you impose that everywhere. It's subject to change within the discovery process, as he laid out in the musical thing. Remember he said it's a developmental process,
mm-hmm.
And then eventually you achieve lawful creative process of musical development. The same as what he said here. It's an interesting use of the word law. Some people would say it sounds fascistic, but let's give LaRouche the benefit of the doubt and see what he's doing. So we're now going to deal, since he's talking about process, you've noticed that the word process is mentioned a lot. Now, McLuhan's language, that's the oral consciousness, not visual space consciousness. Visual space is not so process-oriented. So LaRouche is applying what McLuhan would call an oral sensibility, a Greek sensibility, a pre-literate, pre-printed book sensibility, to the various arts and sciences. So if its emphasis on process, therefore, would not emphasize nouns, it would emphasize, like Bucky Fuller, the verb. So we're going to see the next quote, which is from the same essay which we just read, 1984. The essay is The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals. This is about nounism, all right, versus verbs. So let's see if we can see the same idea of awareness of process leading to a larger or more sophisticated awareness of the lawful principles that cause that process to go along harmonically ordered phases, all right?
Okay.
And this sounds like a lot of words, and it is, but here he is, and he's always going to confront the Aristotelians with the Platonic quote-unquote ideal. So let's go into this one, and you're going to have to name the quotes. Just say quote, quote, blah, 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 quote. You don't have to say unquote.
Okay.
But every time you say quote, that means the next few words you're saying are in quotes.
Formal algebra, like syllogistic systems, is based on the function of the middle term. The middle term has the associated significance of stating such things as, quote, equal to, quote, identical with, quote, not part of, quote, part of, quote, greater than, quote, lesser than, and so forth. The objective of formal mathematics of this sort is to assemble all knowledge, or at least a great part of it, into one gigantic continuous syllogism, such that one might trace one's way from the subject of a single syllogism, turning the page, by way of middle terms, through every syllogism that the entire part of the
through every syllogism in that entire part of human knowledge.
In other words, a syllogistic lattice work.
Now that's by definition visual space, everything connected through a matching middle term. All right?
Mm-hmm.
A middle term that matches various parts of it. Now this is the wrong knowledge. This is the Platonic form of knowledge, okay?
So it's Aristotelian.
This is Aristotelian, as you will see.
Yeah. You just said Platonic.
Oh, sorry.
All knowledge or purported knowledge of this syllogistic form is either anarchistic nominalism, such as the irrationalism of William of Ockham, or is formal nominalism, like that of neo-Aristotelian scholastics. The one is Dionysian, the other
Apollonian.
Apollonian. Both are pure nominalism, comma, nounism.
And that's in italics.
That's in italics.
So you can be either Dionysian or Apollonian. Both are limited. They're not Platonic.
The practical issue is posed by stating that the nominalist approach chooses nouns as the data of experimental inquiry, whereas negentropic approach chooses data from the form of verbs.
Data of the form of verbs. So now he's going to deal with the verb to be.
In the latter method, the verb, quote, to be, unquote, adopts the self-reflexive transitive form of itself, colon, quote, to cause itself to become, unquote.
Yeah, now this is the Platonic way.
Mm-hmm. This is another way of stating the verb, quote, to create, or to, quote, cause to exist. Wherever the verb, quote, to cause is employed, the meaning of that verb is referenced, quote, hereditarily to the verb, quote, to create, comma, quote, to exist, to cause to exist, comma, and to the ultimate verb, quote, to cause itself to become. All verbs, at least as they are employed to define data of scientific thought, must be defined by the hereditary principle of connection to, quote, to cause itself to become, unquote. Insofar as this pertains to the work of classical philologists, we leave the rest of that aspect of the discussion to them, to report how these principles may be located within Sanskrit writings, or at least some among them, and the form of classical Greek used by Plato. Having identified this aspect of the point, we proceed onward.
Okay, now he's quoting he's referring to Sanskrit writings. He's talking about process, emphasizing the verb to be and how it becomes subtly a process within its various forms of expression versus the Aristotelian nounism. Nounism is like what McLuhan called classification, whereas the oral method of the Platonic dialogue is awareness of process. Okay, now we're going to go back, we're going to read the next section, which brings in the well-tempered scales, the musical stuff again, and then we'll go back to what we began with, the music, and try to see some common themes here. I see the common themes as process versus a formula that becomes statically applied, and that's the erroneous Aristotelian method. So LaRouche is saying to be creative, you've got to be not stuck, but you have to be not stuck with a discipline, a rigor of thinking, and gradually beginning to see the lawfulness of a process in unfolding the greater, the better, the advanced. And he says it's like the golden section, so it's difficult stuff, eh?
Yeah.
So that particular quote we just read, I don't know if I gave the page numbers, page 24 of the essay in 1984 called The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals. The next section is another long one, but again he's going to talk about the good and the bad, the Dionysian and the Apollyon versus the Platonic. He's going to bring in the book of the Bible's book of the Genesis. He's going to bring in various famous Greek works like the Iliad and the Odyssey. And this goes like 4 pages?
Yeah, it's 4 pages.
But we're trying, you will see, once you understand this, and if you replay our tapes like this one, if you hear it over and over, you'll hear common themes. So even though I'm including a lot of verbiage from LaRouche, it is revolving around the same dialectic. So by showing all the, by reading all these quotes, having the previous ones in mind, maybe some patterns. I'm using the LaRouche method. I'm trying to get you to see the lawful process in them, the underlying pattern of what is the higher hypothesis he's trying to express. The main thing is that humans are not beasts, and that embedded in our sensory life frustrates thought. And thought is a dynamic, ongoing, never-limited process.
Yeah. And what would thought be like with no sensory process anyway?
Right. Now, LaRouche does write in some of his essays, I don't know if I include them, but he would emphasize this is a thought process that is fully aware of the sensate, but he's not getting bogged down in it. So in the end, he's tactile. He's in between the thought and the sensate. You will see everybody I use in this book is using the tactile interval.
Yeah. Because he thinks that the senses actually are perverse. You actually cannot perceive the reality with any certainty through the senses, because the senses pervert everything that you experience.
Right. If you're not aware of the interval between the thought and the sense, you'll get embedded in one. But it's almost like the Aristotelian is emphasizing thought, but bogging it down in categories. So it's like the sensate version of thought. It's frozen thought.
Yeah. It's so, based on observation.
Yes, and not on the intangible thought process, which intuits patterns which are not evident in the sensory data.
Right.
He's going back and forth between what you see and what is behind it.
Yeah. So he thinks that there's some sort of ordering behind the sensory data.
Yes. And that's what Plato called the archetypes, the ideal forms, were more real than what we saw, and what we experienced in this dimension were dirty, corrupted, polluted versions of the ideal forms.
Right.
But even what I felt like about LaRouche, but even that thought about Plato gets you stuck in looking and romanticizing or reifying the ideal forms. LaRouche remains in the interval, saying that the Platonic method is very subtly, sensuously informed.
Well, is he saying that thought is in the interval between the Platonic ordering and the sensory experience.
Yeah, he would say that just to emphasize the process or the interval.
Yeah.
And see, that's why he's more of an oral person, or the audible tactile cultures that McLuhan talked about, than strictly a print-obsessed Newtonian, Lockean, all the greats of the Gutenberg galaxy. They were embedded in the effect of the printed book. LaRouche is not that.
And that's probably
that's why he denounces everybody during the Gutenberg. The whole Gutenberg heroes are all dupes from his point of view.
Mm, yeah. And it's probably his devotion to Christ which gives him this particular disposition.
Yeah, even his whole, when he does write about Christ, he does not make a big deal out of Christ. He just says he was a better than the Platonists because he democratized and allowed the Platonic method to go to everybody. So he even is, I mean, he's like an intellectual Christian. He's
mm-hmm.
not your conventional Christian. So even, I mean, the way he writes about Christ, no one has ever written about before. He's saying Christ was a, you know, a pro-technologist city builder. you don't get that anywhere else.
Right.
So let's do the next long one. How are we doing for the tape? Are we near the end of the tape?
We got 20 minutes left on this tape.
Lots of space?
20 minutes, yeah.
Okay, good. So this next essay is, or essay, this next long quote is again from the same essay, the 1984, The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals. But if you read, he's writing that in 84, you read stuff in the late 60s, early 70s, it's the same fundamentals, generally. So he's repeating himself a lot through the last 30 years. And that's partly why I offer so many different quotes, to show you he's actually repeating himself. He stays on message, as they say, right? So this is from pages 42, 43, and 44. So let's see if Scott can make it all the way to the end.
Do you want me to read this, or do you want to read this one?
No, I want you, because
okay.
You read it slower. If we have a
all
good
right.
reader, it doesn't, people can't follow it, but you're sort of, you never read it before, you're stumbling along. It's slow. It allows people to take it in.
Okay.
It's a tactile way of
right.
exploring the literary.
So this begins with the relevance, right?
Yeah.
The relevance of the subject of well-tempered scales to our general subtopic here is that the author and his collaborators have demonstrated that the discovery of the well-tempered principle that depends upon the point of departure of a conception equivalent to the
isoparametric principle
and is determined precisely by projection of a self-similar conic spiral into the circular base of the cone.
Onto the circular base of the cone. So what you have here, he's talking about music, the well-tempered scales. And he's applying it to a conception, a thought, and then he relates it to a principle of physics and geometry. Now, we've talked about his use of non-Euclidean geometry, Riemannian geometry, and earlier. And he's mixing music, isoparametric principle, and geometry. All right? So he's mixing up three things that we've touched on already through the course of reading LaRouche's section.
Right.
And you know what he says? It's a point of departure of a conception. Okay.
Earlier he mentions the, you know, if you weren't paying attention, it would go right by it, but he mentions the word that talks about the singularity. And I've noticed that he refers back to this idea of the singularity a lot in other talks that he does. And here, where he talks about the projection of a self-similar conic spiral onto the circular base of the cone, well, if you think of a spiral that's spiraling down towards the point of a cone, in ideal space, that spiral just continues to infinitely...
widen.
Yeah, widen if it's going outward or it never quite reaches a point. If it's going inward, it just becomes infinitely smaller and smaller.
Right.
So I think that's, again, this is, refers to his idea of this singularity, this process, this sort of self-similar process, which actually has no end point.
Yeah, but also
or implodes into a place that of neg entropy because it has no place to finish or something. It just keeps winding up and go, you know, like.
Well, his doesn't. What's unique about his spiral? It emphasizes winding tighter, not widening into the ethereal.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the opposite. In other words, he concretizes it.
Yeah.
And he is involved with our hard, efficient causality technology. You know, he's a hardware guy.
Yeah. So, well, the other place that we come into the idea of the singularity is in the black hole, where matter and light are being, you know, funneled down into a point which it never reaches, you know, it goes into some sort of infinity.
Yeah.
And at that point of infinity, maybe that's where neg entropy occurs or something.
Yeah, it goes into the non-visualizable.
Mm-hmm.
They, in geometry or graph making, they call it asymptotic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The curve never reaches the axis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Never touches the axis.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So after
okay,
this...
Okay, so let's, the implication of this demonstration that he's saying they're doing...
Yeah. The implication of this demonstration is that such notions arise, quote, naturally from applying the verb, quote, to create, to a rigorous study of astronomical evidence.
Yeah, now he's going to go into the Sanskrit culture that studied astronomy. So he's saying these things arise naturally because they're following a lawful process.
Mm-hmm. Although we can merely infer, if rigorously so, that ideas in this direction were implicit in the pre-Vedic Arctic culture, we have more precise indications to related effect from the interaction of the Egyptian temple of Amon with classical Greek culture, as well as leading internal features of Mosaic Judaism.
Yeah, like Moses came out of the temple of Amon, LaRouche claims.
Oh.
He was an Egyptian, you know, high priest.
Why is that significant?
Well, the Egyptians had access to the cultures before them, which would be Atlantean. LaRouche kind of believes there was something, as Plato writes about, that happened before, quite advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls it here the pre-Vedic Arctic culture.
Oh.
So he's saying that the Egyptians then filtered through Moses into Judaic culture, and then that affected classical Greek culture, which is actually the train of line of development of the phonetic alphabet, in McLuhan terms.
Okay.
Okay, so the specific kind.
The specific kind of monotheism of both the Temple of Amon and Moses converges at least upon... consubstantial doctrine of monotheism of Plato's Timaeus. Now, actually, this was an idea I just learned about, I came across recently, was that around the time that Moses invoked the idea of monotheism, it was being invoked by some Egyptian pharaoh around the same time in Egypt.
Right, so this is what they're saying here.
Yeah.
That he picked it up from his Egyptian training.
Yeah, which was pretty radical for an Egyptian pharaoh to do that after a history of thousands of years of all of the mythology that...
Polygods.
Polygods that went before. So reading on, next page. The essential part which the notion of the hypothesis of higher hypothesis performs in the Timaeus and the interdependence of that with geometrical notions rooted in a version of the isoperimetric principle is rigorously demonstrated. It is only necessary, if we are to make such argument conclusive, to show that in Plato's classical Greek, for example, the verb, quote, to be, was sometimes employed in the self-reflexive form of, quote, it causes itself to become, unquote. If physical geometry is defined by a notion equivalent to the isoperimetric principle, and if evidence so ordered is defined as data from the standpoint of the verbal rather than the nominative form, the rigorous development of astronomy for aid of wide-ranging navigation is adequate empirical basis for discovering the existence of a monotheism like Plato's from the evidence of nature.
So astronomy leads to monotheism.
That's interesting. How is he coming to that conclusion?
Well, he'll try to explain.
Yeah, okay.
I would say it's the eye culture.
Yeah, because he's saying the physical geometry leads to astronomy, and somehow
isoparametric principle, which is a certain form of geometry dealing with the conic spiral. And, I mean, he says that geometry and order comes out of the circle, not the line. And Euclidean geometry says it comes from the line. So he's saying this circular, self-similar spiral, think of the galaxies.
Yeah.
That pattern is the way one understands the way nature unfolds. So to be is the same as it causes itself to become.
Mm-hmm.
It implies a process in the second phase.
Yeah. And if it's winding up, in other words, it's going from a wider spiral to a tighter spiral, then it's coming into focus in a way, which is like focusing your attention or something coming into focus or coming into being, maybe.
And then it becomes a figure, and then it bursts into the next interval, and it's a diffuse, vague ground, and as you get to follow the ground and understand its lines of force, you then come to a focus again, a new figure.
Which the thing takes new shape.
Yeah, and then it leaps out of that into a new phase.
Mm-hmm. Mm. This is not to project such an advanced form of monotheism upon the pre-Vedic Arctic civilization of interest to
Tilak.
Is Tilak
ancient,
Egyptian?
Ancient thinker, scientist.
It is only to indicate that such an urban maritime culture was on the track leading towards such advanced notions. Otherwise, it indicates the reasons why the development of the well-tempered system in music tends to reflect the course of development in such directions.
Yes.
What's the relationship here to well-tempered equals geometry equals astronomy equals monotheism?
Yeah, he's saying the higher hypothesis. When you see it form in different cultures, you see that there is a pattern, which is the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, and the hypothesis of this higher hypothesis is that if you're on the right Platonic track, you will come upon the same discoveries, and you can see that the well-tempered system comes upon the same discoveries just as an urban maritime culture way back before Greece and maybe even to Atlantis, but really ancient cultures, which were LaRouche thinks was quite advanced and are indicated such advancements by the Vedic culture, that they all seem to be working on a track leading toward the same advanced notions.
Something that I know about well-tempered system from having learned a bit of piano tuning in the past is that when you're tuning the interval between the resonant beats between any two strings that are vibrating simultaneously, you can only tune the piano to an approximation of the ideal. It's impossible to tune the strings of a piano to the perfect ideal because you're tuning intervals between the relationship between the strings, and you're getting those intervals tuned as getting the beats tuned. This is getting technical, but you're creating tensions in the strings, which create harmonics between the strings, and you're trying to approach the ideal, but you never can. But you can temper; it's well tempered to the degree that you get it as close as possible. But it's kind of like there's a singularity there because it's impossible to get it tuned perfectly. And
that's because the sensory never gets there. But being aware of that means you're keep following the attempt. it sounds like what he said, and we start on page 46. Remember, he's talking about the predicated object. Think of trying to get the perfect tuning as the predicated object.
Mm-hmm.
And he says this sort of use of predicated objects to force the mind to a higher order process conception is identical with the notion of higher hypothesis in Riemann and Cantor's work. So I think there was another. Yeah, he says above that. Yet it is, this is on page 46. Yet it is also essentially something else, a mere predicate of the developmental process. That's tuning music.
Mm-hmm.
What you're trying to get is just a mere predicate of a goal, but you don't get there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is the polemical struggle within the mind between the two kinds of meaning or tuning, which is the musical experience of the audience or the tuner.
Mm-hmm.
See? That's good you bring that up. We can relate it to this very process we're dealing with. In other words, to say you've arrived and know something, LaRouche is undermining. That's nounism.
Mm-hmm.
The process of incompleteness must always be encouraged because that'll lead to new breakthroughs.
Mm-hmm.
Which will never arrive finally at the goal, but it's better than claiming you have arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan would say that the Gutenberg press made people become too goal-oriented because they had solid objects in their hands called books.
Right, and it creates linear thinking, which leads to the belief that there's a beginning and an end.
Yeah, and you miss the spiral.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, when European cultures traveled to other cultures, they discovered the beauty of the spiral and the complicated geometric patterns that they had lost sight of.
Yeah. And artists warn against end-gaining, which is like, I'm just doing this because I want to get to the final goal.
Yeah.
And artists say, well, there's no final goal. You're involved in a process, and it's a continuous process. And stop thinking that you're trying to get from here to there. Be here now in this process and be involved in the process.
Yeah. Now, McLuhan would say, since he doesn't want to identify with any cultural technology and its effect, he would say the electric age emphasizes process because it's audible, tactile, and LaRouche is just a left hemisphere of thinking adapting the print concepts to the processual, which is an effective electric environment. So McLuhan would say that LaRouche is a dupe of the electric effect. But that's just a side comment in comparing. Remember, this book is comparing and contrasting the different ways of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
But let's back in. We're exploring and accepting LaRouche's assumptions while we're doing LaRouche.
Yeah. Well, maybe just like you'll never get perfect agreement between the strings on the piano that you're trying to tune, you'll never get perfect agreement between McLuhan and LaRouche.
Yeah, you didn't catch the dialogue between Harold Channer and I.
Not yet, no.
Yeah, that's not available yet. I don't think. But you will see that Harold and I, in a sense, are talking about the same thing, but we never can stop and agree on one word.
Mm-hmm.
And then remain fixated on that one word.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of any dialogue between Harold and me is exactly what you're saying. We never come to exact agreement.
Yeah, but you're involved in the process of the dialogue, which is more the Socratic or the Platonic, as opposed to the debate, which is probably more Aristotelian.
Yeah, more goal-oriented. That's right. We supplement each other.
Yeah.
At the same time, thinking the other guy doesn't get what I'm saying.
Right. In the debate, one side is trying to conquer and abolish the other.
Yeah.
In the dialogue, two sides are trying to get closer and closer together.
Right, but they recognize they won't, so they accept the dissonance.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's continue here.
Okay.
In the same vein.
In the same vein, we must compare the degraded conception of man and nature embedded in the writing of Hesiod with the heroic conception of man of the Iliad and Odyssey. The latter conception better, more clearly defined by
Aeschylus's
Prometheus, rejects the evil gods of Hesiod's pantheon and usurpers.
Aeschylus Prometheus rejects the evil gods of Hesiod's pantheon as usurpers.
As usurpers, and references a higher power implicitly to the composer of
Timaeus. Implicitly the composer of Plato's Timaeus. But was it
It's hard to read when you don't.
Bobby with
it's hard to read when you don't know what the hell he's saying.
Zappa had a character called Potato Head Bobby, but the higher we reference the higher power, which is the asymptotic. You don't get there. You keep working, keep trying to conceive the inconceptual,
mm-hmm.
but embedded in the sensory effects of the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is provocative. Okay.
Okay. It is provocative to read what
the Arteris Siculus
reports the ancient Atlas people to say of the Hesiodic pantheon, that all these supposed gods were nothing more than a principally rascally collection of fellows whose civil strife destroyed the culture of the urban maritime colonization of their region.
Yeah, here he's talking about before you got into the stupid cliche Greek god culture. There was this very advanced urban maritime culture, which the gods, which were a bunch of bad Aristotelians, locked down the urban maritime culture, and it became ossified in general Greek culture.
Mm-hmm.
Until Plato came along with the revolution,
mm-hmm.
or Socrates and Plato,
mm-hmm.
and some of the playwrights like Aeschylus. So he's talking about the sort of moving into almost a dark age from some interesting or very creative culture way back there that had some influence perhaps on the Vedic culture or was of the similar high quality.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So the gods, LaRouche is not impressed with the god culture.
The plural god culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was like a fetishization.
Yeah.
Like
but if you were going to try to synthesize all those gods into the